Hi, friends. Welcome to True Crime with Ivana Estelle. Yes, I have changed my name. Actually, to be honest, when I first recorded this, I said True Crime Storytime, and I was like, oh, wait, I've changed. And I know it is kind of like back-to-back changes with me, but I just felt like I was ready for something like different. It just didn't feel right anymore. And that's not to shade any podcast with a super fun name, because I follow and listen to a few and their shows are doing great work and they're so well done. It's just not really for me anymore. Plus, because I write other shows under the pen name Ivana Estelle, which is also my real name, it just felt like it fits better leading by my name. Anyway, I was supposed to cover another serial killer today, yikes, but as I was getting my writing together to cover Charlie Cullen, I took a sneak peek at the next case I had. It's a story about a wife that had gone missing, and like we almost always say, the husband did it, but it was just way too interesting to me to stop researching. And by interesting, I mean intriguing. Because the audacity of those involved in this case is one where you'll want more than just justice for the victim. This case will resonate with anyone who has ever been betrayed in the worst way by someone they loved and trusted. And it'll resonate with anyone that's ever felt something off about a person, but just didn't have the evidence to back it up. At least not yet. This is the story of Anna Walsh. New Year's is supposed to be a time for a reset. Your night where your resolutions are ready to come in action, toasted with a glass of champagne. But in the hours of 4:50 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. on January 1st, something happened. In the quiet of the night, a woman, 39-year-old mother and wife, Anna Walsh, disappeared. Anna was much more than a wife and mother, though. Anna was known to be outgoing, kind, and ambitious. She worked in the hospitality business and was splitting her time between Massachusetts and D.C. D.C., for those of you who may not know, that, by the way, is me shading all D.C. listeners. I live here, but last I checked, not a lot of people that live in D.C. listen to this podcast. Too busy dealing with the UFO probes, I guess. No pun intended. Okay, I'm completely teasing. Ah, I'm such a shit talker today. Oh, no. I need to be nicer. I love everyone who listens, no matter where you're from. And I love my DC listeners too. Okay. Plus, I'm a New Jersey native anyway. I'm a freaking transplant. But I know that DC is known for being the microphone of America, being thought of as a political arena. But it also is known as a place that is an ideal metropolitan area. It is small enough to get around easily on the metro train or via Uber. There are new restaurants coming up all the time, and tourists are known for visiting the museums and National Mall. It's also a hub for hospitality as well, especially during the holidays and summertime. Anna was establishing herself in the real estate business. She was a regional manager of a company called Tishman Speyer. Originally, Anna was from Belgrade, Serbia, the capital of the Southeast European country of Serbia. It's known as Serbia's largest city and has stunning views of the city skyline. Anna had lived there for years. She went to college there, obtaining a BA in French. In 2005, at the age of 22, she emigrated to the United States. During that time, she was granted dual citizenship. And over the next 10 years, she really established her career working in the hospitality industry. According to Boston 25 News, she married Brian Walsh in 2016. By then, she was 32 and a freaking powerhouse. She was known for having an incredible work ethic and being so intelligent. I mean, at this point, she knew like three languages. Anna, on the surface, you see this beautiful young woman who eventually found love. And so when she went missing, it is so easy to think that she was just a stunning housewife by the photo alone. But the more you get to know Anna, the more you realize she was so much more than that. And it's not surprising that her life went this way. She was a magnet for people. She had a lot of friends and her family loved her. She caught Brian's eye because of her large eyes and chestnut brown hair and her kind smile. The two actually met in Massachusetts during the time Anna was working at the Whately Hotel. And after about 2 years of dating, they were married. Now, I'm going to get more into this relationship because it wasn't clear on the outside, the depths of it, but there is a lot to talk about when it comes to the two of them. And there were cracks that were beginning to show, right? Around the time that Anna went missing. But let's talk about Brian for a minute. Brian Walsh was older, by about 7 years. And at the time when he and Anna met, he was decently successful. In the photos now, you see an older man with a square-shaped head, grainy black hair, normally pushed back out of his face, small thin lips, and eyes that were beady but dead. But it wasn't always that way. In 2010, Brian was known to saunter table to table through a restaurant. In one particular example, it was called Sandrine's French Bistro, located in Harvard Square in Massachusetts. It was one of those places similar to restaurants in D.C. Slightly high-end, you would catch anyone that makes about $100K a year and up dining there. Clinking glasses, talking passionately to one another as bottles of wine were poured. Brian was known to throw these elaborate dinner parties at Boston hotspots. A couple places like Select Oyster Bar and Puritan Company. Brian was always the master of ceremonies, and he would introduce his kitchen crew and the head chef, thanking everyone for coming. Brian, at the time, had begun to make a name for himself. He was known as a restaurateur, racking up large tabs for friends that he hosted. Along with all his success, little did anyone know, he didn't have much emotional control over his money. A spending habit, to be subtle. Brian would be known for buying like $25,000 bottles of wine. He wanted chefs tasting menus everywhere he went, which, by the way, I recently did that for my boyfriend's birthday. It was just the two of us and it was expensive as hell. Nowhere near Brian's tab, but doing that regularly can obviously burn a hole in your pocket. Brian, however, did it effortlessly. No one had any idea that though he was known for ordering an entire menu's worth of food for his events, that he was struggling. Brian was all about perception. At this time, before his mugshots were out on display for the entire world, he was youthful looking, lean and tall, known to be sophisticated and a lover of art. He took big vacations and was always offering travel advice or hotel recommendations. But he was somewhat of a Great Gatsby of sorts. He, at the time, claimed to own a house on Beacon Street. It was about 5 stories and 6,000 square feet. He never entertained in this home, though, unlike Gatsby. He always threw dinner parties at the most exclusive and expensive restaurants. So, actually, maybe the diners made more than $100,000 a year. Let's boost that up to like $150,000, $200,000 and more. His peers were wealthy, and he gave off the idea that he too was wealthy. But Brian could never, ever be completely, Okay, so there was something about him that just seemed off. Like, he felt the need to tell extravagant tales, like the time he claimed that he had a college roommate that had sold an airline ticket service to Expedia for close to $200 million. He told people that he made his money off of oil fields in New Guinea, and that's how he ended up getting into the restaurant business, off of the wealth of that. But the truth was, Brian didn't own that home in Beacon Street. He didn't have a best friend that was a millionaire, and he damn sure didn't really have any business in New Guinea, not that I could track. It was actually his mother's house on Beacon Street. And a lot of the money that he spent around town was from extending credit cards. He was in a copious amount of debt. But I'd imagine by the time Anna stepped foot in his life, he couldn't bring himself to tell the truth. And I think we all know a person like this. Maybe not to that degree, but someone who everyone seems to like, but maybe for some reason you, listener, just can't put your finger on why you don't. I had an experience like this. In fact, it almost cost me the relationship with my boss. Someone that I knew deep down in my bones wasn't right, but everyone around loved them. And I can't be alone in a situation like this. Like, you can't pinpoint why, but just something feels off and untrustworthy about this person. Maybe they're a friend's significant other, or a cousin's best friend, or a coworker, or an old college friend's new friend that they brought around. Just a person that you know that you probably should keep at arm's length. Brian, despite all his flair, had feelings of shame. Growing up, he'd even spent time at a psychiatric hospital when he was young and was allegedly diagnosed as a sociopath, but for years was able to abide. And in 2016, after being newly married to Anna and tying her into this lifestyle, it's kind of not clear how much she knew. According to their social media pages, photos of them, they looked really happy and in love. And as the years went by, they ended up having three beautiful children. They were in this new home now, an incredibly large house in Massachusetts. But before I get to this picture-perfect life and this picture-perfect home, one that he actually did live in with his wife Anna and their children, I want to stay in 2016, just for a moment. Because there at a Four Seasons, Brian sat with a large bag holding two portraits. They were framed perfectly, and if you were to see him, you would think, regular wealthy man. You've gone from a restaurateur to an art curator now, though. See, Brian was meeting with a man named Ron Rivlin, who was from the Revolver Gallery in LA. Brian was going to sell him two Andy Warhol pieces. He'd explained that he was running into money trouble and that he needed to sell the pieces quickly. Now, there should have been some shock that at first he was trying to sell Andy Warhol pieces on eBay. He had come up with some reasoning about not being able to auction them off, but I'm assuming Ron was just so excited and agreed to pay $80,000 in cash for the pieces. And by the time Ron flew back from Massachusetts to LA, it was clear that these paintings were fake. Ron had gotten them tested again for authenticity, and upon realizing that Ron had been frauded, Brian had used the money to pay off a few credit card bills and was essentially missing in action. The address on the contact was Beacon Street, a place where we know his mother had the deed. Eventually, Ron did hear back from Brian, though, after calling repeatedly. And Brian said that the money would be deposited in Ron's bank account. And Brian did keep somewhat of his word. He transferred about $30,000 back. But that other money? That wasn't happening. But Ron Rivlin was not to be messed with. And a federal investigation into Brian began. But it would take nearly a year and a half for anything to come up about it. In fact, it was in May 2018 that FBI agents walked up to Brian's loft in Lynn, Massachusetts. He and Anna had moved there. See, as it turns out, for more than 5 years, Brian had been running a scam. It started in 2011 during a trip to South Korea. He had convinced more friends of his that Andy Warhol pieces that he had were real. And basically, what he would do is he would sell fake art. He'd show the originals and then sell the fakes, and he ended up really racking up a lot of money. See, Ron was just the tip of the iceberg. Brian is a fraudster, it's clear, and it didn't matter the victim. He scammed friends and strangers, doing the same gimmick. But by 2018, After being told that he had to pay nearly $250,000 to his victims in restitution, he found another scam. See, during the time of his legal troubles in 2018, Brian learned that his dad had passed away while on a trip to India. However, when Brian went to collect any money that would be in the will, in typical greedy fashion, there was a problem, at least for Brian. See, in his father's will, there was a single line that referred to Brian. The will of Thomas M. Walsh III sat on a simple desk in Father Walsh's house. But that line was heavier than any furniture could ever be. For it read, "I hereby bequeath to Brian R. Walsh my best wishes, but nothing else from my estate." Brian had been estranged from his father for more than a decade, and this was after his father had accused him of trying to steal nearly $1 million from his own estate. But Brian wasn't ready to accept this, and court records showed that he denied that he had ever even seen his father's will, and he filed paperwork in Plymouth County petitioning the court to name him as his father's only child and sole representative of his father's estate, in the absence of any will. And by December of 2018, the court agreed. Now, this is confusing to me because I believe every will is supposed to have an executor, so I don't know how Brian was able to do this. But I did end up talking to my mom, who is a will and estate attorney, and she explained that wills can be destroyed, or people can hide them. Or if a person passes away, banks aren't immediately notified. So whoever is their last, like, next of kin or like connection to that account can drain it. People also don't always update their wills. So think about those who get divorced. If they have a will and haven't updated it yet, they need to, because should something happen to them, it could be their ex that receives everything. That's just an example though. But at least at the time, Brian was given about $76,000, and he took more than 100 of his father's prized possessions and began selling them off. I'm talking jewelry, cars, anything expensive, you name it. Now, this would catch up to him eventually because in February of 2020, right before COVID hit, the probate court declared that a picture that Jeffrey Orenstein, who was a very close friend of Thomas Walsh, Brian's father, had, was valid. And that picture was actually of the will. Now, that's about all I have information-wise about this will. So I know, I'm sure there's more questions and answers than you may have right now. But all I can say is if you're young and a listener, talk to your parents. If you're a little bit older, if you've started kind of finding your footing, make sure that you start to look into having your affairs in order. You never know, whether it's your family or yourself. You guys know my tangents. Look out for each other and look out for your family and make sure that there's something in order, because you never know how people can change when money's involved. 1 year later, Brian pled guilty to charges related to art forgeries and was placed under house arrest until his formal sentencing. It also was around the time that his scams from his father was going to result in more financial and legal strain. Now, Anna, during this time, had been doing extremely well for herself. She transitioned from the hospitality industry to real estate, and over the next few years had no choice but to become the sole breadwinner. That huge house that had been paid for and at one point financially covered more so by Brian was now her responsibility. And Anna had actually known Brian for a while. So they really met in 2008. She at the time was married to someone else, the chef at the hotel that she worked at. And things just weren't working out. I just think it was a real strained timing. I just feel like it was a really difficult time. I mean, she was struggling with her first marriage, and then she meets this sophisticated illusion of Brian. The two fall in love, and I think they know each other and are friends and then start dating. And then they're engaged for a couple of years. As I said before, they get married. The timeline of them knowing each other, dating, being engaged, and being married is all a bit different from sources that I've researched. But the two do fall in love, and over the next few years, after moving from Lenox to Wheatley, Anna moved to DC, and she and Brian split their time. She'd gone from being a front office manager at the Willard Intercontinental to a front desk manager to front operations manager. As she would continue to climb the ladder, she and Brian's friendship turned into love, and as I said before, they dated for a couple of years, and then they got married. And Anna liked the lifestyle. She'd worked hard, and it was nice having a wealthy friend and then Beau. They'd spent a lot of their time at high-end hotels and at those fancy dinners that Brian was always throwing. It seemed that Anna didn't really know much about Brian's goings-ons. When she was living with Brian, she didn't think about the fact that his mother was living with them on that Beacon Street house. And then when they moved to the loft, she was just relieved to be away from her mother-in-law. It wasn't until his legal troubles became public that Anna really started seeing the issues. But she wasn't very outspoken about it with other people. She didn't seem privy to a lot of the scams, but just the aftermath of them. And Brian was also able to talk his way out of a lot of those things over the next several years. Anna also was really focused. She was building a real estate portfolio of homes, and she was able to flip them or rent them out. And then she ended up getting a job with Jem Mutulu and the Mutulu Group, which specialized in selling high-end homes. Now, there seems to be a lot more money coming in at this point, right? And before that, 2020 hit, where Brian was essentially having his lies caught up to him, and that perception of them was starting to be side-eyed, they were a gorgeous couple with amazing kids. Brian was known as a fun-loving guy. But it was hard on Anna, because at this point, from leaving the hotel industry to getting into the real estate industry, she was going back and forth from D.C., and when she left the Mutulu Group and took her final job, she was able to buy a house in D.C. In Chevy Chase, to be exact, which, by the way, is an extremely expensive neighborhood. It just seemed like life in D.C. needed to be where the kids were stationed. And around that time, of course, Brian was starting to lose money. All of those legal troubles were crashing into him. Brian literally was dealing with having an ankle monitor and having to stay home. It was pretty quiet, like I said, the issues in their marriage. But there were slight whispers, like the fact that prior to being married in 2014, when Anna was still going back and forth from her own home in Massachusetts to DC, she'd actually reported to the police that her boyfriend from Boston had threatened to kill her. She didn't end up pressing formal charges. She'd also sent a few text messages to friends that Brian was becoming violent. And now, in 2022, Anna was dealing with the sprinkles of issues with Brian, plus the gaping hole that was to be Brian's future legal troubles, plus their financial issues, and Anna was ready to be out. And it's always interesting because whenever we read about, like, these con artists that finally get caught or really violent men that finally get caught and we think about their wives, Anna wasn't necessarily outspoken about Brian's legal issues, as I'm sure they started to surface, but she did have those two moments where she called the police due to his violence and was texting her friends, not necessarily talking about their financial issues, but about her safety and how Brian was literally losing his mind and she wasn't feeling safe. And honestly, everyone's different in relationships, right? Like, there are some people that are very private about their relationships. There are others that are a little bit more outspoken. The last night Anna was seen alive, she appeared to be happy. On that unseasonably warm New Year's Eve, she and Brian gathered around their kitchen counter at home in Cohasset, Massachusetts, with their dear friend and Anna's former boss, Jem Mutulu. They were going to ring in 2023. The dinner Brian had painstakingly prepared bubbled away in the kitchen while the Walsh's three sons played in the living room. Her old boss explained that things seemed pretty normal. Now, granted, being close with your boss or anyone at work, there's always a bit of a barrier, right? New or old. So maybe Anna put her best foot forward at the dinner instead of letting her former boss know what was really going on, like she had with a few other friends. Because even though she was all happy and smiles on January 1st, it would be the last time anyone would see her alive again. Apparently, her time in Massachusetts in general was brief. She had a work emergency entering the new year and would have to race back to DC. And according to her husband, Brian, after dinner, Anna took a rideshare to Boston Logan International Airport to fly to Washington, DC. But there was no evidence that she got on the plane. And this wouldn't be discovered for another 3 days. Because it was January 4th when Anna was officially reported missing by both her husband and her co-workers in DC. See, no one had heard from Anna. 4 days. There hadn't been any phone activity, and since she never actually arrived in DC, her co-workers were scrambling to trace her. But call after call, there was no sign of Anna. Police searched areas in Massachusetts near Anna's home and near places in DC that Anna could have been, but with no actual evidence of her ever getting on a flight and consequently no evidence of her taking any form of a rideshare, it wasn't clear where she was. So thus began the dig. Did Anna have any enemies? Anyone with work who would have wanted her out of the picture? What about Brian? I mean, he'd stolen a lot of money. Could there be anyone that would have wanted to hurt Brian so they went for Anna? See, at this point, it didn't seem like Anna disappeared on her own accord. She may have had dual citizenship, but she had 3 kids. Besides, her plan, as it turned out, was to move to DC permanently. She told friends and coworkers that she, being the breadwinner, and Brian pleading guilty to interstate transportation for a scheme to defraud and possession of converted goods and unlawful monetary transaction connected to his past schemes, I could go on and on and on, was stuck with an ankle monitor, unable to leave Massachusetts without letting the courts know, at least. Now, just to let you all know, with ankle monitors, they don't work in the way that we see them on TV, where you literally, like, have to be in the house. You can technically leave your home, especially if you're working or going to go see your parole officer. The monitor literally tracks where you are, but in the sense that it can tell if you leave the state or go a certain distance. It essentially is an itchier, shittier Find My Friends. Oh, and you have to charge it as well. So, like, you can't go super far without stopping to charge it. Brian, at this time, had an ankle monitor on. And though his exact whereabouts weren't always immediately located with police, it allowed him to go to different vicinities. Like, he could pick up and drop off his kids, things like that, go to dinner. Upon Anna's disappearance, Brian seemed to be confused more than anything. He knew that Anna was going back to DC for work. But for Chief William Quigley, something just seemed off about Brian. After a lovely holiday dinner and entering the new year, Anna gets ready to go to DC, but her husband doesn't check on her when she says that she's leaving. He doesn't wake up to see her off. She had to take like a 4 a.m. Uber, so you don't just check in at least. And then 4 days go by and Brian doesn't hear from Anna. He isn't suspicious or worried about when she landed. He waits till the 4th, the same day that her friends are filing a missing persons report, to decide that he's going to report her missing. He claims, like I said, that she left around 3 or 4 in the morning and that he was fast asleep. But something just doesn't feel right. Like, you didn't have to take your kids to school in the morning. Lord knows you didn't have to get up for work. Why hadn't you seen your wife off and then checked to see if she'd made it to D.C. safely? The next thing that didn't add up to Quigley was how perfect this ideal marriage seemed. With Brian fighting his legal troubles, Quigley began to dive into this case, and it struck him as odd. See, he began to interview friends and learned that Anna had told these very friends that she was planning to move permanently to D.C. And if she was planning to move, we knew the result of Brian's case meant that he wouldn't be able to move anytime soon. We're only left to assume that they would be separated. So, how strong of a marriage was this? If Anna was willing to be a single full-time mom, working as well in a completely different city, And would Brian, a man known for upholding an image of perfection, be left in Massachusetts and just allow that? Well, the next bombshell that would be revealed may have changed the trajectory of this case. See, Anna wasn't just physically moving to DC. She was planning to leave Brian. She had emotionally been out of the marriage for a while. Court documents revealed that Anna was having an affair. She'd been seeing another man for a few months. They'd spend Thanksgiving together and even vacationed in Ireland. Anna was falling for someone else and was ready to make major changes to her life, starting by ending her marriage. But see, police weren't the only people aware of this, because so was Brian. He and his mother had hired a private investigator on December 26th leading up to Anna's disappearance and had caught Anna's unfaithfulness. Police were able to speak to the other man, who remains anonymous, and by all accounts, the two were in love. They'd spent Christmas Eve together and were planning on rekindling on January 4th of all days, the day Anna was confirmed to be missing. Police could consider this man being the culprit, but again, his alibi was clear. He was in D.C. Anna had gone missing in Massachusetts. So to solidify the timeline, it appears that Anna was in D.C. up until Christmas, came home for the week, and planned to be back in D.C. on or around January 1st or 2nd. Court documents found that Anna had allegedly given her husband, Brian, an ultimatum. As he pled guilty and was looking at a long road with potential incarceration, she wanted full custody of the kids, and she was leaving to live in D.C. So now we had motive, a pending separation, a potential affair, and a man with a violent streak who didn't trust his wife, but was at risk of losing his family. But according to Instagram and social media, the couple seemed fine. Anna was getting her ducks in a row. She was just doing it privately. With that, police were able to search the home and seize all technology, including iPads, phones, and computers. And what they found shook even the strongest cop to his core. I'll get a little bit more into that warrant a little bit later. I have to jump the gun on this one because it's just so fucking crazy. Sorry, excuse my French. First, there were the petty things. Brian had regularly checked social media, stalking his wife and her friends, and looked at one particular account regularly. He had also obtained the phone number to Anna's new partner in D.C. Police were able to find that he had, in fact, hired that private investigator. So, as they knew about Anna's personal love life, so had he. But it was what was on their son's iPad that was the most damning. See, at this point, the three boys were all under the age of 10, so there was no way that they could have been looking up the following things. Internet searches, and precisely when each of them was entered, starting in the early hours of January 1st, the day Anna Walsh was last seen alive, Norfolk Assistant District Attorney Lynn Belland said that the searches were conducted on Brian Walsh's phone and on his son's iPad. At 4:55 a.m., how long before a body starts to smell? At 4:58 a.m., how to stop a body from decomposing? At 5:47 a.m., 10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to. That wasn't all. See, those searches around Anna's home and town may not have been able to reveal Anna, but they did find a few things. Investigators found trash bags with blood, a hatchet, a hacksaw, a rug, and used cleaning supplies at a transfer station in Peabody, which is about 46 miles outside of Cohasset, Massachusetts, where Anna and Brian lived, as well as items inside of the home and in the woods out back. Things like cleaning supplies and towels. But the most damning, a broken knife and blood were found in the home's basement. Now, back to Peabody. To see, 46 miles is a long drive. And remember, I said that tracker. It wouldn't have been able to tell exactly where Brian was unless he left the state or went too far out of limit. But Brian's explanations were not exactly panning out. He told investigators that he had gone to the grocery store and the pharmacy on the actual day of the 1st and 2nd, that he'd spent the mornings puttering around, and he also figured because Anna had traveled so much and then not talking regularly wasn't too strange, when he hadn't heard from her after calling, that maybe she was just busy. By this point, police were also beginning to have a better picture of what their marriage was, so maybe Brian had a point. But when police went to verify the supermarket and pharmacy on tape, there was not any evidence of him being there. However, there was a surveillance video showing him at a juice bar on the same day, and video footage reviewed by CBS Boston investigative team showed Brian near a liquor store dumpster in Swampscott, Massachusetts. Sources told CBS Boston that no physical evidence was found there, and maybe evidence wasn't placed in that dumpster. But what was Brian doing out in Swampscott? Well, he had actually done a lot of driving on January 2nd. See, that juice bar, also known as Press Juice Bar in Norwell, where he's seen front and center on camera, seemed innocent. Brian claimed, yeah, maybe I wasn't on footage at the store or the pharmacy, but I was at that juice bar to get my son a milkshake. But investigators say that that was more so to throw off the scent. See, several hours after this juice bar stop, Brian Walsh was at a Home Depot in Rockland. He allegedly bought $450 in cleaning supplies in cash. The alleged trip to Home Depot would be a violation of his house arrest. It was way too far at that point, so what would make him risk house arrest issues and spend almost $500 on cleaning supplies? Investigators said that they found more footage on January 3rd of a man resembling Brian Walsh throwing what appeared to be heavy trash bags into a dumpster at an apartment complex in Abington, not far from Cohasset. So I've named a couple of different towns, and investigators believe that basically Brian was driving really far out to go buy cleaning supplies, and then driving really far out to go throw away evidence, and then driving really far out to go, like, scope areas. Police believe that they had enough to arrest Brian Walsh, but not on murderous charges, but for misleading police. See, he was driving all over and hadn't mentioned any of that. He basically said on the morning of the 1st and the morning of the 2nd, he'd spent his time going to the pharmacy or going to the grocery store. And on January 8th, Brian was arrested. But the day before, something strange happened. Police in Cohasset, Massachusetts received a ransom note asking for $127,000 for the return of Anna in the days after her disappearance. A court affidavit released Friday showed that a Cohasset police detective, Harrison Schmidt, received an email on January 7th at 5:18 in the morning from a Gmail account saying, "We have someone named Anna Walsh with us here. We had a deal worth $127,000. She messed up. We have her here with us, and if she doesn't pay the money, then she'll never be back. And we know that the police and the FBI are involved. Good luck finding us." But here's the thing. A Gmail account is trackable, and it wouldn't take long for police to realize that this was a fluke. Though it's not publicly admitted whether it was Brian or someone playing a sick joke, it wasn't enough to dissuade police from arresting Brian. He was able to make bail for the misleading and went back home. But he also wasn't looked at as a flight risk because of the fact that he had an ankle monitor and was dealing with separate charges. However, he'd only be home for a brief amount of time because 10 days later on the 18th, Brian would be arrested again. And this time, it was for the murder of his wife. So what made the difference? Well, in the first 4 days between the arrest, there was a lot of swift changes. The first being the 4th and 5th were dedicated to a public search, asking anyone to come forward if they knew any information. The 6th, though, according to CBS News, was when a fire broke out at the Walsh's former residence. According to a police log, there were 4 occupants, 3 adults and 1 child that escaped before first responders arrived, and no one was really injured. Nothing was really damaged. Police characterized it as a crime scene. According to the log, though, there didn't appear to be anything suspicious, and it didn't get in any way of the investigation of Anna's disappearance. Searches continued after this, and the police weren't public about anything they found, probably because Cohasset was known to be one of the safest places in the United States. Most people living there were millionaires, and all leads, as police would uncover, seemed to circle back to Brian. On the 8th, an actual search warrant for the homes, electronics, and insides were obtained, and that is when Brian was ultimately arrested for the misleading of the investigation. On January 9th, Brian was arraigned in Quincy District Court. He pleaded not guilty to a single charge and was ordered to be held on a $500,000 bail. His next time due in court would be February 9th, but it would be the 18th that he was arrested again for Anna's murder. On the 10th, this is where police continued to investigate other areas that interested them, including multiple dumpsters. 8 days later, after compiling evidence, both physical and technological, Norfolk County District Attorney Michael W. Morrissey announced his office issued a murder warrant in the case. The police believe that Brian found out about the affair, knew that Anna was planning to leave, and after that night of the dinner, assaulted Anna. They also believe that he dismembered her body. I hadn't mentioned this, but other searches that came up on the computer were things like hacksaw best tool to dismember. Can you be charged with a murder without a body? And can you identify a body with broken teeth? There was no longer belief that Anna had been held somewhere against her will. It was freezing Massachusetts at this point, so if she was kidnapped, she would have been without food or water. But it was evident to police that Anna was likely dead and murdered between the 1st and 2nd. There was one final piece of evidence that wasn't publicly released, or at least wasn't as shocking as Brian's Google searches, and that was that Anna had taken out a $2.7 million life insurance policy, naming her husband as the sole beneficiary. Her husband, who she was planning to leave. To me, that was the most horrific piece of it all, because Brian was a person who didn't care, not about his friends, his father, or his wife, and was willing to murder her and then try and steal from her. Defense attorney Tracy Miner requested the court release Brian from custody, but the judge ordered him to be held now without bail pending indictment. The judge also issued a court order to seal probable cause affidavit and arrest warrant until March 10th. Impoundment prevents the public, but not the parties, from gaining access to the records. So basically, there's more to uncover that we just don't know about yet. But on March 30th, 2023, a Norfolk County grand jury indicted Brian Walsh on charges of murder and misleading a police investigation and obstruction of justice. First-degree murder conviction in Massachusetts carries a mandatory sentence of about life imprisonment without parole. And on April 27th, Brian pled not guilty to the charges, and it is likely he believes if they do not find Anna that he may have a chance to be free. But there are a number of cases where just because there's not a body doesn't mean the perpetrator didn't go down for murder. Gail Katz is one example. She was killed by her husband, and he dropped her body via plane over the Atlantic. 20 years later, he was charged with her murder. Brian is facing charges related to fraud, so regardless, he will be spending time in prison. Anna is still missing. She was a smart, driven, kind person. She was a career woman and a great mother, and she didn't deserve to be murdered, much less at the hands of her husband, someone who she'd known for over 15 years. And more than anything, Anna had almost protected him. She didn't talk about her plans or his financial issues to anyone. She just wanted to get her kids and really have her life in D.C. Anna's family is in Serbia and trying to get as much information as they can, and her friends in the U.S. are making sure that this case stays out in the public. As for those three kids, it's not clear where they are at this time, but they are left without a mother or a father in all of this. Those photos of Anna and Brian on Instagram show a smiling family of five. But it all just seems a bit darker now. It is true. You never know what is really going on behind a perfect picture. Thank you all for joining me. This case is relatively new and unfolding, and as of now, Anna has yet to be found. I am sure updates to this case will be occurring. My heart goes out to Anna and her family and her children. If you find yourself in a relationship that is abusive, unhealthy, toxic, please know that you do not have to stay. You deserve better. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233 or text START to 88788. Time for our true crime fact of the episode. This one is about a hero, actually. Lois Gibson holds the Guinness World Record for being the most successful forensic artist of all time. She has helped Houston Police Department solve over 1,000 crimes. Gibson's motivation to seek justice came from personal experience when, at the age of 21, she was assaulted and nearly killed. She says, "I got attacked by a guy who almost choked me to death for 25 minutes straight." Later, by accident, she witnessed police arresting her rapist. "I saw the arrest," she said. "I know what it's like to see justice. It changes your life." During her career, Ms. Gibson has worked on a number of high-profile cases and authored a textbook called Forensic Art Essentials. Thank you all for joining me. Please tell your friends and family about this show, and please leave a 5-star review. I actually don't look at reviews because they may hurt my feelings sometimes, but the majority of them are really, really nice. So please, if you have something kind to share, please send my way and share this show. All of my sources are going to be on YvonneSL.com. There was an incredible article that really helped me paint the picture of Brian and Anna. This case is really, really well covered. And I just think one thing that everyone should note about these podcasts are that we can't do this if it isn't people that come before us that are on the ground, really doing the reporting. And so I always make sure to list all my sources because, I am able to tell this story thanks to the incredible information that I'm given. Anyway, you can follow me on at Ivana Estelle True Crime, and I will see you all in a couple weeks for another case. Safe journey. Keep walking in the light. With love. Until next time, Ivana Estelle.